All right. Do you guys have any questions?
What's your cat's name?
Renfield.
Renfield,
Yeah. What are your cat's names?
I have two cats named Spooky and Lester.
Cute.
They're brothers. They're my
Armando,
world.
do you have any cats?
We have an outdoor building cat called named Biscuit.
Adorable. I
Cats
love that.
rule.
Yeah, agreed. And welcome back to the Rick Retreat Horror Cast, hosted by yours Ghoulie, Ricky J. Duarte. I am so excited about my guests this week. In honor of Valentine's Day, we are featuring two really creative individuals, huge, huge fans of the film that we're talking about, My Bloody Valentine. Please welcome to the show, Anthony Massey and Armando Munoz.
Great to be here.
Thanks for inviting us.
Oh, man, I'm so excited, guys. So, to my listeners, these are two extremely creative individuals. Anthony Massey is the creator and leader of Stop the Killer Games. So he will tell us more and more about that, but essentially board games based on some of our favorite classic slasher films. And Armando is an author, an incredibly talented writer, and has just finished and released a novelization, It's About Time, of the 1981 classic slasher flick, My Bloody Valentine. Anthony, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about Stop the Killer and about the game?
Yeah, well, Stop the Killer was something that happened last year. The first game in the series was based on Silent Night, Deadly Night, which is another title that I just love. I mean, it's such a classic film. It was controversial and everything. And I'm producing the remake of Silent Night, Deadly Night. And the property holders, or I guess the IP holders, Scott and Dennis of Silent Night, Deadly Night, I was helping them set up licensing deals for various products. You know, it was like, we got to get Silent Night, Deadly Night back in the zeitgeist and all of that. And so Scott had mentioned, and I was confused on the phone. He was like, how about a game board? And I was like, what's a game? Like, I was like, what's a game board? You know, but he said, like, you know, wrapping paper, cards. We did a pop-up card, by the way, greeting cards, ornaments, obvious things. And then he said game board, and I hung up the phone. And I'm like, what the hell is a game? And I went, oh, he must have meant board game. I don't know. I just was like, it was just kind of, he flipped the term or whatever. And I went, oh, a board game, duh, like my thick head. And so I'm a magician, so as well. And so what I do as a magician is I create experiences for audiences. You know, whenever I create a magic trick, I'm designing a moment of wonder that people can sort of like fall into and enjoy and say like, wow, that was great. I create experience of this is what magicians do. And so I just, in my own free time, just started designing a board game on Silent Night, Deadly Night that fit the theme of the movie. And so that's how it kind of started. And so that game came out. It was a Kickstarter. It was very successful. And my partner in it is Fright Rags. And Fright Rags, if you don't know, if you're watching, fright-rags.com, they're our partner for Stop the Killer. And they're the top retail, one in the top echelon of horror retail, merchant online horror merchandise. And they do incredible artwork. And so Scott had done some licensing with them. And so they did the artwork for Silent Night, Deadly Night. So we just found the My Bloody Valentine property. The folks over at Cinepix who own My Bloody Valentine are the most amazing, wonderful people. They love the idea of a board game. And so we took the same game, we took Silent Night, Deadly Night, and rebranded it with My Bloody Valentine. Because if you'll notice in like slasher movies, and you guys have to agree with me, or let me know if you agree with me, there's tropes. There's like a formula. There's typically a killer that's trying to get somewhere. There's typically an officer, you know, the Officer Barnes and Silent Night, Deadly Night, Chief Newbie and My Bloody Valentine, and the Halloween movies, there's Sheriff Brackett. There seems to be like this formula. So Stop the Killer was born out of, the name just sort of came to us because it was like Stop the Killer. That's what the game, that's the objective of the game. You're trying to stop the killer from getting from one place to another. And so that's kind of what happened. And it's just taken off, and we're doing another game next. We have another game lined up after that. And we're going to start to design some games that are, that play differently. You know, they're not all the same, but for right now we're finding those movies that have like this formula and creating a series called Stop the Killer. And I just named the company Stop the Killer because it's a great name, and stopthekiller.com was available. That was shocking to me. So I'm like, that's the name of the company, but that's kind of how it, you know, how it happened.
Holy shit, this game is so much fun. I just played it. Yes. So I got mine.
So I got, like, the fact that you said that to me, like, that's all we, that was, I want to hear every comment, but all I wanted to do and it was create fun. That's it. I just wanted people, I'm sorry, I keep talking because I'm so fucking excited. Go, can I swear?
Good. Okay. Yes. Okay.
Listen, there's nothing worse when you're developing a game and no one's having fun. Like, it's being executed and everything, but it's not fun, you know? And the things that ding you in that area is your turn takes too long. You don't want to have too much to do on your turn. You don't want it to be too complicated. You don't want to take it out and spend an hour reading the instructions. And so as long as the fun factor is there, that's what we work. That was the work. The illustrations was not my doing. You know, that's all Justin Osborne at Fright Rags and all of that. But what I worked on was the experience. So I'm just elated that you said that. So proceed.
Well, it's so cool that the illustrations match the Fright Rags art. I would say a good quarter of my wardrobe comes from Fright Rags.
Oh, yeah. You and me both. Yeah, for sure.
Big fan of the, you know, the stuff that they have to offer. Yeah. So I was I finished the book last night.
Oh, wow.
And then today I rewatched the movie this morning, and I've seen it a million times. And so I'm watching the movie while I'm playing the game, wearing my Bloody Valentine t-shirt. And so listeners, the great thing, as Anthony was mentioning, kind of playability and having fun, this is for players 1 through 4. So like, I don't have anybody around. I'm going to play my Bloody Valentine. And I had a great time because you're playing against the minor. You're playing against Harry Warden, which is, that's a really cool aspect, right? Is that you're dodging him along the board. And I don't know, if you're like me and you're planning to spend Valentine's Day playing with yourself anyway, you may as well throw a board game in, right?
You know, that was the whole, you know, it's like, what do you do on Valentine's Day? Even if you have a partner or not, you know, it's like you go to dinner, you watch a movie. This is like something that we really put an effort into saying, make it part of your Valentine's Day tradition. Silent Night, Deadly Night, make it part of your holiday tradition. You know, it's the game you pull out every year and you just sort of add it. And on those key holidays, you don't want to have to relearn the game and spend an hour reading instructions. When we were developing, you don't just design a game and release it. You have to develop, test. I mean, these are extremely important steps, and I went to great lengths to make sure that it was satisfying. There were no mistakes in it, and every time we tested it, it got better because somebody would say, "You know, would it be even better?" And I'm like, "Tell me," you know. And so a lot of people had comments about just various things that made its way into the game. So yeah, so you know, instead of just sitting there watching the movie, play the game while you're watching the movie, you know. Yeah. And so, and everybody's objective in the movie is the same. So it doesn't matter. Like you said, Ricky, you can play 1 to 4 players. You're all trying to accomplish the same goal of stopping Harry. So if any one of 4 people stops Harry, you all win because you've all successfully overcome Harry Warden, and the games play differently. I don't know how many times you've played it, but if you play 2 to 3 games back to back, you'll see different endings. And that was another thing we made sure happened is that, like I always say that I played the game twice with a couple of, it was 3 of us. In one game, this guy Cameron killed Harry within the first, you know, half of the game, within like 10 minutes. In the other game, Harry took us all out and we were all dead, you know? And it was like, you're playing the same game and yet there was a completely different result. And so, so you could play 2 or 3 games and put it away and then pull it out off the shelf the next year. So
and that's the vibe I get. I mean, the, you know, the cards that you draw make it a different experience.
Yes.
Every time. I love that you can also, if you draw a certain card, you can help out some, one of the other players too, right?
Yeah.
Which is a great aspect as well. So
yeah.
You're kind of working as a team against Harry, which is
And think about any horror movie. You know, that's what they do in, you know, My Bloody Valentine. They all make each other very aware. They're like, Harry's back, you know, and they what do? They all scramble to survive together. No one's trying to do anything to hurt, you know, if you've seen the movie, that may veer a little bit, but no one's trying to hurt anyone. So in the gameplay, it's the same thing. So
absolutely. Yeah. You have multiple players to choose from. I selected Mabel. And
I love Fools is my favorite. I told George Mahalka that. So when we designed the game, we had a Zoom and I said, Mabel will be my forever piece. I'll never play the game as not Mabel. And George laughed. Yeah. He loved the game. He thought it was very, he said, I like its simplicity. He goes, but it doesn't look easy. And I said, that's the whole key. It's simple, but not easy. That I thought was the key to the games.
That's exactly it. Because even if I was in the middle of gameplay and I had a question, I just looked at the instructions and that's cool. What I do. It was
awesome.
Super easy. Definitely easy. My second choice would have been TJ, but he looks like, the guy who plays TJ in the movie. Is it Paul Kelman? Is that the actor?
Yeah.
Yeah, he looks exactly like my first boyfriend, like alarmingly identical to him. So I selected Mabel, and I hope the miner gets him. There he is.
I love it. Oh my God.
There he is. So,
and you know, it's really hard, but there's a quick side beat, and Armando knows this because he just wrote the novel. You know, the cast is huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, My Bloody Valentine, I mean, I can't name another horror movie that has as many. There probably is, but it's just, you can only play up to four people. So it's like, who do you pick? And invariably, when we announced who it was, people were like, oh, but I love Patty. Oh, but I love Hollis. And it's like, all right. So we put a bunch of new characters in the expansion packs, which you can only get in the Kickstarter. It's very important. If you're watching and you want these games, just contribute to our Kickstarter because you won't get the expansions anywhere else. And that's where all of the extra goodies are. So
yeah, guys, I slept on the kicks. I didn't sleep on it. It was a very, very busy time of year for me, and I totally missed it. But as of today, we're recording this on Sunday, the 5th?
5th.
We're recording this on Sunday the 5th. As of today, the game is still available on Fright Rag's website.
Oh, cool.
So you can
awesome.
Still get it. We're releasing this on February 10th, on Friday the 10th. I don't know. For the sake of your pocketbook, I hope it is sold out. But for the sake of my listeners, I hope they have a little bit of a chance to get this game. But if you don't, as Anthony said, sign up for the mailing list. Get on the Kickstarter. Do you want to tell my listeners what the next game in your series is?
Yes, it is Halloween 2. We're doing Halloween 2 next.
So fucking cool.
And I'm really... Halloween 2 is a huge one. It is one of my favorite horror movies. Armando, isn't it your it's like your favorite horror movie, right? Or one?
No, it's my favorite movie.
It's your favorite
in existence.
Wow,
nothing.
That's amazing.
So, my excitement levels through the roof.
Yeah, and you know, here's the things. It plays the same, you know. And again, that's the whole reason for the series. And you know, we did a tutorial for the folks at Universal. We walked them through the game. They had questions. They were very engaged. They loved it. They thought it felt very retro, you know. They don't just approve anything. You have to get an approval thumbs up, you know. And I've worked with licensing on my documentaries and all kinds of stuff, and you can't assume anything. And right now, I've seen the artwork for it. I wish I could show you guys. Oh my God, with Justin Osborne has done, it is insane what he's done. I was like, oh my God, you know? I know I sound like a kid, but like, I think these games are serving up new ways to experience the movie. And I think that's why they're successful. If you like Halloween 2, you just got to pick it up. Play it every October. you're going to love this game. We're doing a lot of really fun things with it. So,
well, I think you're both filling a space that is not, like, has not been met up until now. So why don't we take a moment and we're going to move over to talk to Armando about the novelization. Now, you both worked closely with George Mahalka, the director of the original film.
Yes.
Armando, tell us all about this novel. Tell us, just go for it. I'm so excited to hear.
Well, I'll say that, you know, Anthony brought me in first based on my prior work. And I believe he was a fan of Hoarder, which was my first novel. And I had also followed that up with the first two entries in a Thanksgiving slasher series that I've been writing since the first one, Turkey Day, came out in 2016. And then Turkey Kitchen came out in the follow-up in late 2021. And so I have some experience, you know, adapt or putting slashers on the page, holiday themed, very much, you know, adhering to this formula that we love so much. And he also knew my love for My Bloody Valentine. And so, you know, he approached me first, but then we had to get George Mialka's approval. And so that was a whole nother step. So I got on a Zoom with him and to kind of get his idea and to pitch my kind of view of the book and what I wanted to do. And thankfully, we were just completely on the same page from the beginning. I think one of the first things he said to me was, I'll tell you what this movie, the story's about. It's about the Rust Belt. And I just clicked with that right away because that was kind of how I was coming into it. Focusing on the community, focusing on the realities of making that environment and town real. And all of the hardships and the history. And there was just so much to work with. I mean, I love all the traditional elements as well, but I knew that that wouldn't just adapt, you know, directly into a novel. You have to add a lot more to really make it real. And so George and I both had a realism approach that just totally gelled. And we just talked countless hours about everything in the universe, all the characters, all the story beats, and then, so he was really there to guide me through the whole thing, to give me everything that was cut, the things he wanted to change or expand. You know, he had some ideas, like from the very beginning, he wanted to increase the stakes of the original cave-in in 1960. And then the film, I believe it's five miners get trapped down there and eaten by Harry Warden. In the book, it's 20, and that involves a lot more suffering and carnage. And so things like that, we got to really kind of beef up. But yeah, he was there for through the whole process from the beginning to end. So everything is with his stamp of approval. Anything that's new that people aren't expecting, you know, it's totally got his seal on it as well. But that said, he gave me an unbelievable amount of freedom, creative freedom, to bring the town and the characters to life. I mean, we all have our own ideas of who these people are, and we have our favorites. And I have to say, they're all my favorites. I love every character in the story, and to be able to tell their stories and to get into their heads and their thoughts, it's such a joy. Like, I can't even say, like, for a fan, it was pure immersion into the world. And I was living in Valentine Bluffs for months. Every day, every moment was with those characters. What a joy. I hope my excitement is palpable in those pages.
it truly, truly is. I follow you on social media, and so mm-hmm. I see the way that you talk about this book. You have reason to be proud. You have accomplished a lot in this novelization. I don't want to sound like cliche, but I couldn't put it down. This is a film that I think it has endured, and we're going to talk about why we think it has endured for so long. But there is such a realistic connection between these characters. You could see yourself as one of the group. They you know, clearly grew up together, and you took that and you expounded upon it. You know, and you talk about the things that George also wanted to amplify. The whole, is it chapter 13 where they go into detail about the what happened in the mine? I believe that's like Happy telling his backstory. That chapter was my favorite chapter because it's so gross. And you know, it's just it's so imaginative because it is, you know, this film is famous for having been censored. Mm-hmm. And yes. So it's amazing to see these moments that really could have and should have made it to the screen. Obviously, you know, the scene with the drill is infamously lost to right. cinematic ruin, but to be that I was so excited to get to that part in your book because I wanted to know what happened in this infamous lost scene, you know, that was cut and then unfortunately lost.
Oh, George described every single edit of what he shot and made sure that I adhered to exactly his vision of the double murder.
That's so amazing. You even, so watching the movie today, having finished the book last night, I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh shit. Like, you take things in the background that I had never noticed before.
Yep.
Like Dave standing at the cage in the bar reading a book and ignoring this chick. And I had never even noticed that happening before. And I won't give it away to the listeners because, guys, you have to read this book. But the book that he's reading, I was like, oh no, this all makes sense now. And I, being who I am, really appreciated that inclusion as well. I always got a little bit of a vibe, if I'm honest, but you know,
absolutely.
you took, you know, adding, you know, expounding on the wild dogs in the area was so cool. It adds this ominous presence of something encroaching. Just the film is atmospheric and creepy and visually stunning, and you have made this novel atmospheric and creepy. And it becomes visually stunning in your mind because you think that you know Valentine Bluffs and you know, you think that you know these characters, and you've made it, you know, you've taken everything that I love about them and added even more to it.
Well,
so I'm just obsessed. I really am. Like, I will be reading this every year, every January leading up until Valentine's Day.
This that's great to hear.
I have like my October reads. This is going to be my January, February read.
I have the same, you know, habit, and I've been collecting novelizations since the mid-80s, actually the early 80s. I mean, if this book had existed before now, it would have been on my shelf decades ago, but it never did exist. And luckily I have this opportunity to now put it on the shelf. But, you know, some of those novelizations really kind of feel just like padded out screenplays, mm-hmm. and they don't really get into the meat of it all. And even despite the fact that some of those, you know, older slasher novelizations are on my shelf, I would still, even if I didn't think it was the best book, I would still reread them, you know, around holiday season, you know, because it still helped get me in the spirit, even if it's just the cover and the characters, you know, in general. And so I have that same habit. And, you know, I would hope that people would enjoy this enough to give it an occasional annual reading, but also to reappreciate, you know, give some added reappreciation to the film. It is seeing those things that you may have overlooked in prior viewings. And, you know, I'll describe one in general, just a little moment that to me was so special. And I always noticed it in the film, but then really studying it as I was writing it, Mabel drops all of her fabric hearts that she made for the Union Hall dance, and they get dirty, and Howard has to help her collect them. And then they have this tender little moment inside the Union Hall where she's complaining about having to spend the night rewashing, you know, all of her hearts. And he apologizes again to her. And then they share a look and a smile. And immediately it just suddenly clicked. It was just, they have a history. They have a sexual history, and it totally makes sense with the characters and where they came from, you know, that Mabel was Howard's first, you know, some years ago. And now I'll always see that when I see that tender look between them in the film. It just, moments like that, those connections that time and history, you know, bring within a community, and bringing those out and, you know, putting a spotlight on those. I think it's a really fun for people who love these people.
I agree. I love the backstory that you've given to Mabel. How much of that was you and how much of that was George? Like, did George give you any guidance for these characters' backstories?
Most of it was me. It was kind of just how I viewed these people. I did tell George immediately before we started, I was like, you know, I may have different interpretation of some of these characters, that he may not expect, but, you know, just to be open to it and see if things work. And in every single case, he was completely happy with who these people became in the book. Another one would be the very first victim, the woman in the mine, who in the film is really just, you know, she's just there to serve the purpose of titillation and horror and doesn't really have a purpose. And I had to make her real and give her a history and give her, and I wanted you to like her and feel, yeah, and root for her and then feel bad when she gets murdered, even though we know it's coming there right there at the start. And George liked how I built her up and actually gave her a purpose, you know, for being like, there's a reason that this woman, Stella, is the first victim. There's a reason that Mabel is the second victim. And those were things that we never had before. So in a way, this tragedy had to unfold this way. But he was great. Like, you know, I did tell him I wanted to potentially, you know, be open with sexuality of the characters and make it real, because that is the truth of the matter. You go to a small town and anywhere, and on the surface, it may all appear like everybody's straight and in a certain way, but in reality, when the doors close, you know, and what's going on in people's heads, you don't know. And there's always going to be people who, you know, there's going to be different sexualities throughout. And George was thankfully very open to letting me see where that was just naturally where it worked. You know, I wasn't trying to put it in a way that was false. You know, it had to feel real to me. And I already had my suspicions on certain characters. And you rewatch the film and you see clues now that, you know, I don't know if the actors brought certain things to the roles or not, but it was there for me.
And by the way, we mailed books to all the cast, so they're going to be reading it shortly. So I'm eager to see what the cast thinks of what happens to a lot of their characters.
Oh, that's so cool.
George said, you know, hey, here are all the emails. And I contacted everyone and everyone gave me their address. And it was like, oh my God, they're going to see another version of this movie.
Yeah.
And all these gaps are going to be filled in. Yeah.
Well, as I mentioned with the game and now with the novel, this is filling a space. Like, I mean, on my bookshelf, next to the novel will be the board game. And, you know, just on display, they look beautiful. The art on the dust jacket of the book is amazing. The hardcover of the book, when you remove the dust jacket, is so cool. Who was the artist who did these?
So the artist was Gary Pullen. So yeah, so the book cover, there's two different covers. You know, the actual hardcover has a very simple, you know, it's two upside down hearts, which Gary actually designed it with two right side up hearts, you know, and it was George that said, can you flip them upside down? And it made all the difference. Like, you look at My Bloody Valentine and the hearts are upside down, like immediately. Like, the artwork is really, I think in the world of horror, and you guys can agree, artwork has become a huge part of the experience. And so we see these posters and, you know, the game, the board games, I was going to say game board, the board games, they really do. It's like, oh, what is this? It's a new way to experience it. And so George and his wife, Susan was very involved as well with this. Susan reached out to Gary and said, can you please do something amazing for this book? And, you know, it's incredible.
It is. It's got a retro vintage feel. I just, I can't wait for more. Armando, are you allowed to announce what's next for you?
I believe so. Silent Night, Deadly Night, which I mentioned at the end of the, about the authors, kind of where I'm focusing right now. But Anthony and I are talking about a series of titles that we both have interest in. For the future, and I can't say anything about that as of yet, but the goal is to do a line of classic slasher novelizations along this line. And hopefully the audience will welcome these.
Yeah.
I I'm sure that they will. I also, because I'm now a new fan of your writing, I cannot wait to check out Hoarder. I can't wait to check out, is it Turkey Day and Turkey Kitchen? I'm a big old fan.
Yeah, last night we were at a signing. We were at a book and game launch at Dark Delicacies bookstore. And I saw people buying your book, Armando. So like,
nice.
Yeah, that's the thing is like I know a lot of writers, and when I had mentioned, I said, hey, you know, George, what about a novel? I saw the opportunity to connect Armando with, you know, with any, I mean, you name any slasher title, like Armando's your guy, like, you know, and I felt like he was just an untapped resource for this kind of project. And so all I did was just help get them connected. And just, I just stepped back and was like, what do you guys need? I'll support you. You know, I'll take the pre-orders. I'll help market it. I put it all together. But there is, when you said there, you know, Ricky, you said about filling a gap or there's a need for this. There really is, because, you know, the tie-in novels that we're all used to from way back when are, you know, they're meant to be read in a day or a weekend very quickly. And they're not supposed to veer too much. You know, I have all the Halloween novels. I mean, they do add a little, you know, nugget here and there. But I think what we need, what horror fans crave is, like when I read My Bloody Valentine, I was reading the pages as Armando was sending it to me. My heart was racing because these pages felt like they were in the movie. If that makes sense, it's like, well, I know they're not there, but they feel like they were there. And I think that's what is resonating. I think when, you know, people are just starting to read it, we've just sent out all the novels. Valentine's Day is coming. And I have a feeling in the next week or two, we're going to get all of the reaction. And that's the vision for the series. It's like, you name any slasher title. I actually had somebody, I don't know, Armando, if I told you this, but I won't say the name of the movie, but somebody sent me unsolicited a manuscript for a slasher title that was half of the length that I would want. I mean, it was like they immediately crossed it off my list because I'm like, well, you sent it to me now. You've put me in this very precarious situation where I can't pursue this now because you sent me something. And I was like, you know, so please don't do that, anybody listening. Don't send me a manuscript for a slasher movie because it will just destroy what I've been working on. But the vision is to create, you know, this book was also huge. I mean, Armando took out, how many words did you take out, Armando? Like, it was bigger.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. Like, I only had to really cut down 7,000 words or so.
Yeah.
I think.
But we have to fit a certain amount of pages. You know what I mean? Like, there's expense. And once you go over a certain amount of pages. So I just made sure all of that was my job, was to just make sure it was shaped, executed, shipped, all that stuff.
It could have been a longer book. If we didn't have those restrictions, I could have gotten another.
Yeah.
50 pages in there.
Speaking of that, for first edition, there is an added chapter. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. So which chapter is the added chapter?
13.
Oh my God. I knew it. I knew it. God, it's... Well, because I was trying to think and I was like, which one like is amazing, but like could maybe not be that. Man, it's such a good chapter. You guys got to get your hands on the first edition of this book because it's a fucking great chapter.
The challenge with that, and I remember talking to Armando, was like, how do you just pull out a chapter in the second edition and not screw up the narrative of the book? And Armando did it. And it's great. I mean, I remember I texted you, Armando, after, and I was like, this is the greatest chapter. Like, I was as thrilled, Ricky, with it as you were. I was like, this is so great. I mean, I couldn't wait for people to start reading it. So,
Armando, I opened up my quarterly issue of Fangoria magazine. And I read it cover to cover. And so I get to a certain part of the magazine and happen to see you all over it. You got a 3-page spread in Fangoria magazine. That's fucking amazing. How did that feel?
Yeah, I'm pretty amazed. It feels incredible. I, you know, was weaned on Fangoria. I've been reading it every single issue since the first issue of 1985. And I've gotten all the past ones since then. But, you know, so to get this kind of coverage in the pages, and, you know, being able to speak with George Majalka about this project is just, it does feel a bit unreal.
Dreams come true.
It's a beautiful spread, you know, with Gary Poland's artwork over the 3 pages, and I couldn't be more thrilled.
Well, now, I mean, now that I have finished the book, I'm a writer for Rue Morgue's website, so I'm getting my ass on getting a review written and submitting it to my editor. He hasn't assigned it to me. This is me being like, hey, I need you to publish this. So like, yeah. So if I can get that review out as soon as possible, I would, do anything I can to bolster this. Where, all right, we have to start talking about this movie, but where can people find this game and sign up for more Kickstarters? Where can people find this novel currently? And where can we sign up for more information about upcoming novels?
Well, all you have to do is go to stopthekiller.com and sign up for our mailing list. And our the company doesn't bombard you. We don't send out emails every day. That's my pet peeve. So every now and then we send out an email that's important. And so you can go there now, right now, and just you'll be alerted. And the thing that's I thought was devastating was we only printed up a certain amount because this is the first book, and we had to navigate and figure out how to execute it and not overspend and make sure that the licensor was happy and everything. But we knew this wasn't going to be an Amazon book, or we wanted it to be special. For a second printing, the licensor is responsible for that. I'm talking to them actually tomorrow. Armando, I don't know if I told you, but I'm talking to them tomorrow about how to go about pursuing the second edition. But they do want the book all over the place. But this first edition, that's what what I want the novels to be and the games to be is just, we're going to serve you the best experience of it. The extra chapter, the exclusive artwork, though you get a bookmark. Also, Armando and George, this can't be understated. Every book that was purchased received an autographed book plate by George and Armando. The logistics of that was nightmarish. It was like,
yeah, did they send these to one of you first and then to the other next?
And so you have to think about it. They signed endless amount. Like, it was, I said to George, can you actually do this in a week? And I'm sure. And I'm like, yeah, but can you actually do it? Their markers weren't working. And then they screwed this one up. And then it got sent to Armando and he had to sign them. And I went and picked them. I mean, it was like, each one had to be packaged. And that's what I did. It's like, but I knew that when people got it, people were going to say, holy wow, this was just, it's just so worth it, So
it was such a nice touch because it felt like it looked like a little Valentine card and with a little heart sticker and opened it up. And it really, it was a great touch. And then the bookmark, it's so funny, when I got the box, I was like, which bookmark am I going to use? And then I opened it up and there's a My Bloody Valentine bookmark in there. It was great. It was a cool, unexpected touch.
I think that's what I've just learned in, just everything that I do is you've got to put your everything into it. You have to. I mean, otherwise, what's the point? And again, I said I know other writers and I love my writer friends, but the right writer, that's it. Who should write this book? That's the only, if you can answer that question with the right writer. And Armando and I have a great friendship, and it's just, I know that he's amazing. I'm a big fan of Armando's writing. I'm so glad it worked out this way. Armando, I'm glad you didn't write a shitty book because you know what I mean? Like, I'm so grateful for you, So watching last night, meeting everybody and signing the book, I was like, oh, you so deserve this. It's so great.
And I stick to impossible deadlines.
Armando, your writing has been like blessed by Clive Barker. That's correct, right?
Yes. Yeah. He is.
He's given you his stamp of approval on your writing. So you clearly had what it took to tackle this project.
Yeah, he's kind of been a mentor to me for some years.
Oh my god.
So I very much appreciate that. He's been very open and helpful with as a writer, talking writer to writer. It's an incredible channel and person to have.
Yeah. What an opportunity. And Anthony, before we step into talking about the film, you kind of mentioned in passing, and don't think I didn't notice it, that you are producing the upcoming Silent Night, Deadly Night remake.
Yeah.
Is there anything you can tell?
Yeah, that is. Well, it's been a very, very long journey. The licensor, Scott, and his partner is Dennis. The movie, if anybody knows the movie, they know it's plagued with, we call it, there's a naughty history of Silent Night, Deadly Night. It's just one of these films that just from the start has just been a nightmare. There's been five or six movies in the series. Really, nobody really knows that. the first movie is really great, but it was only in theaters for a week before it got pulled. And like, so I had met these guys during COVID and set up a deal to remake the movie with them. And that was 3 years ago. You know, almost this May will be 3 years, and it's just been really, really, really difficult to get it off the ground. But this coming week, we feel like there's a meeting we're having, and we feel like we found our home, and we're going to race forward because, you know, horror movies are back now. And, you know, low budget horror movies, Skinamarink just made 60 times its budget or more. Terrifier 2 made like $11 million, something like that. Winnie the Pooh is coming out. Like these low budget films, the horror movies are coming into theaters and striking a chord. And that's what it used to be. Like I saw the Beast Within in theaters back when I was a teenager, you know, and it's like, you just feel like that it's circled back now. And I think the time is right for Silent Night, Deadly Night. And so we have really good ideas for it. And it's just, I think finally time. And I haven't remade a lot of movies. I haven't made a lot of movies. I've made documentaries and I've made shorts and I've done all kinds of things. But I've never had an IP like this. And my first question to George was, do you have the film rights for My Bloody Valentine? Like,
oh God, yeah.
You know, and they don't, they just have the merch rights. And so I think Lionsgate owns,
interesting. My Bloody
Valentine. But did you guys like the remake of My Bloody Valentine?
I was going to bring it up. I tried to watch it twice this week. And here's the thing. When it came out, I had a good time watching it. It was in 3D. It was ridiculous. I had a crush on Jensen Ackles. Everybody did. And now it's just, if I'm going to spend that time watching it, I'm just going to watch the original. Like, I don't think it's hurting anybody. It's kind of a fun movie, but if I'm going to spend that time, I'd rather just watch the original.
Yeah.
I think it's a good time, you know, splatter slasher. It's totally fine.
Yeah.
Do I have the deep, same deep connection as to the original? No, not quite. So it doesn't get as much rotation. I look forward to the day when I can have a good 3D TV and a way to watch it that's not through red and blue glasses and see it in that way again.
Which yeah, was, that's you know, the way to see it. Such a great crowd movie. Yeah,
well, yeah. Fun, now watching know? Watching it without the glasses, now you just see all of these shots that are obviously clearly much cooler in 3D. Mm-hmm. Well, listen, why don't Anthony? Wait, what do you think of the remake?
I love it. I mean, I remember it was just I loved it. It was one of the in my mind there are a couple of horror experiences, you know, Paranormal Activity. Even like Scary Movie, even though it's a comedy, but like there are some audience, like the audience I saw My Bloody Valentine 3D with, which is crazy. They just loved every frame of it. And I remember I had gone to Dark Dells. That's when they had their original location. I think they were on Burbank. Their original location. It was right as the movie. The night before I had seen the movie and I was going to Dark Dells and I saw the writer, Todd Farmer, crossing the street to walk into the store. And I said, it's Todd. I was like, and I had interviewed Todd for one of my documentaries. And I said, I just saw it last night. It's like instantly in my top 10. Like I was so jazzed by it, you know, that I was like, I love this fucking movie. Like it was so great. So yeah, I watch it every year. I put the glasses on and I sit on my couch and watch it every day. I love it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I preferred to watch the original leading up to this. I will, before Valentine's Day, finish the remake. But hey, why don't we take this moment and step into the film My Bloody Valentine. Let's go trick-or-treating.
Awesome.
So today we are talking about the original My Bloody Valentine. This was part of the kind of the Canucksploitation kind of phase in horror. We had such hits as Happy Birthday to Me was a part of that. I believe Terror Train was a Canadian horror film, right? It was slew of horror films coming out of Canada in the early to mid 80s. A lot of them were classics and a lot of them surrounded holidays or special events. Valentine's Day had not yet been featured. It was perfect timing. John Baird has written the screenplay, of course, directed by George Mayalka, 1981. We're going to go through some notable cast members. Paul Kelman plays TJ. Now, Paul passed away last year. Is that correct? Around this time? I think I read that.
I believe so, yeah. It's been about a year.
Yeah.
Laurie Hollier as Sarah, who went on to be on Star Trek Voyager. Neil Affleck as Axel. We have Keith Knight as Hollis, Alp Humphreys as Howard, Cynthia Dale as Patty, Helene Udi as Sylvia, Rob Stein as John, Thomas Kovacs as Mike, Terry Waterland as Harriet, Carl Marotti as Dave, Jim Murchison as Tommy, Gina Dick as Gretchen, and Peter Cowper playing the minor slash Harry Warden, Don Franks as Chief Newbie, Patricia Hamilton as Mabel, Larry Reynolds as Mary Haniger, and Jack Venera as Happy. This is a big cast, just as you mentioned before. I think my episode on Happy Birthday to Me was a struggle to keep up with how many characters were in that movie as well, but we're going to do our best with this. And you guys know them a little more intimately than I do. So movie opens and we have two people in mining gear walking through a dirty old mine. One of them is noticeably larger than the other, for sure. And we get one of them kind of leaning up with their back against the wall. The other kind of steps toward the camera and almost looks around a little bit. I want to take a second and talk about how cool the aesthetic of a miner's uniform is as a killer. Because I was thinking, and honestly, Armando, I think it was during the book that I realized you can't hide in the dark from these from a miner. They have a light on their helmet. So, like, he will find you, you know? True.
Exactly.
A pickaxe is a great weapon. It's huge. It's blunt. You can use it in many ways, and it's menacing.
It's rusty. It's chipped. It's got dried blood all over it. It's heavy.
Absolutely. As we find out in one of the kills, parts of this uniform are kind of like resistant to temperature, right? Like these gloves can withstand boiling hot dog water. So the ventilation mask adds a really scary breathing factor to it as well. I do think it's like a primed, excellent killer sort of uniform.
Oh yeah, the breathing is terrifying.
So scary.
When you hear that mechanical breath behind you.
Yep, and these kind of dark bug-like eyes, right, that you can't see past the lenses of. So the smaller miner starts to unbutton their uniform, revealing a woman. Takes off her mask. She's a beautiful, beautiful blonde woman. She has the tattoo of a heart on her chest over where her heart would be. She goes to remove the mask of the other miner. The miner whispers, "No." And she probably finds this a little kinky. I mean, I love that the book goes into greater detail about this, right?
Yeah, it gets pretty steamy.
It gets real steamy.
At times I thought I was writing 50 Shades of Slasher.
Well, I think it works particularly for a book about Valentine's Day, right? Love and sex is in the air. So is blood. So the miner has a little bit of a reaction to seeing the heart on her chest. And before she knows it, she is shoved up against the wall. There's a pickaxe on the wall behind her. And in the film, it just looks like something was cut because you see it start to protrude through her skin, but you don't see it pierce. And the camera zooms into her open mouth in a scream. And we get our title card, My Bloody Valentine, with two hearts in the O's. One of them drips a drop of blood. And now we know what kind of movie we're in for.
Absolutely.
Sex and violence.
Sex and violence.
Kicks it off, and then the opening title. It's all there right away.
If you don't want to watch that movie after that, you're not a slasher fan. You know, that's pretty much, they got it so right. George got it right.
It's true. It's got everything we need right in that setup. We cut to next scene is going to be the guys down in the mine. They are finishing up after a long day. They are filthy head to toe. So what do? They strip off their clothing and get naked together and start showering.
Great way to get to know them all.
Movie does a great job of introducing a lot of characters really fast. You just have to pay attention in like the first 10 minutes of this film or you're not going to know who anybody is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as Armando said, you know, it is really a great way to get to know everybody very sort of quickly. And they're all likable. You know, you can get the sense of like who these guys are and how they, you know, they're like, they're a family, you know what I mean? Like yeah. they work together, they shower together, they go to, you know, the cage bar together. Everybody knows everybody. So right away, you know, this is a small town, a mining town. And you just get that sense of camaraderie. It's what I love about the movie is these characters that, you know, the biggest challenge in any horror movie is, do you like these characters? Do you like them? And do you root for them? And right away, you're liking them and rooting for them. So that's why I think it's a strongest point of the movie, actually.
I agree. I think, first off, I look at pictures of my parents in 1981 and they look just like these kids. Cool. And yeah, real quick sense of everyone's camaraderie. It's a small town and they've got each other. It is like a family. We learn real fast that TJ and Axel have a bit of beef between them. TJ has just returned. He went out west to California for a year, didn't tell anybody that he was going, didn't tell anybody he was coming back. And he used to be kind of the leader of the group. Really not anymore. Turns out Axel is now dating TJ's former girl, Sarah. TJ wants her back. Drama ensues. So they get out of the mine and everybody jumps into their cars to race. And we get like a Dukes of Hazzard kind of kind of score going on as they rush to meet up with the girls at the Union Hall.
I love that scene so much.
It's great. It's, I mean, I don't call it silly. It's just fun. You know, they drive past the Valentine Bluffs Welcome to Valentine's Bluff sign, which has now become iconic. It's got neon hearts, three of them inside of each other. It looks like the heart is beating. Population of not very many people. filmed in Nova Scotia in an actual mining town that I read, they spent, once they found out that a film team was going to come and film in their mines, they spent like $50,000 renovating the mines to make it look suitable for a movie. And the film crew got there and was like, what the fuck? This doesn't work. We need an old, dirty, rusty mine. So they had to spend a big chunk of the, like $75,000 of the film's budget to try to make it look dirty again. But you know, those Canadians always trying to be helpful and accommodating.
Right.
We get to the Union Hall and we've already met the boys. Now we're going to meet the girls and they are setting up for a Valentine's Day dance. It's the first one in 20 years because 20 years ago, disaster struck. And we'll learn why a little bit later when they get to the cage. But for now, everyone's really cute. Everyone's in love or trying to be in love or just trying to get laid. We got a lot of homemade Valentine's Day decorations going up. And this is all being overseen by Mabel, who is a mature woman who owns a laundrette in town. She's kind of spearheading this whole experience. I always wish we got more time with Mabel.
Mabel is like one of my favorite. I mean, who doesn't love Mabel? She's like this.
Thank you for being a friend.
She seems like everybody's like confidant.
Your heart is.
You know, she's the one you go to talk to when you got a problem. And, you know, she's that comforting character. For some reason, it's, you know, like she's dressed the way she is and everything.
Thank you for being a friend.
Yeah, she's great. One of my favorite characters. And, you know, I was really pissed when I learned that her scene was cut. I mean, when you watch the uncut version of that scene of her getting killed, it is really brutal. I mean, it's hard to watch what happens to this woman that is so nice. And she's like, you know, her, you know, what is it? Mayor Haniger's like, your decorating committee has done a wonderful job. And, you know, she's carrying her hearts and she's, you know, like she's bringing back Valentine's Day and you just love her. And so I had a hard time seeing her demise. I really did. You know, a lot of horror movies, you just don't really like, you don't really care. You know, they're going to die. But with Mabel, it was just so, and also when she turns and says, you know, when she sees the box of hearts, that's, I know, maybe we can talk about that a little bit later because that's coming up in the movie. But like her death was just really disturbing to me. What did you guys think?
Oh, yeah, I love her so much. In fact, it was so important that from the beginning, I give her more than we had in the movie. And the second chapter, chapter two, is all material that's not in the film, but setting up the whole history of the town and its residents. And that chapter kind of ends up putting a spotlight on Mabel. Mabel unhappy, you know, I wanted to bring into the story earlier and start with their history and their feud as well. And so, you know, I knew right away that the book was going to have more Mabel. And I definitely pushed you know, gave her much more of an expanded character than a lot of the characters. You know, it was very important for me to give us satisfactory time with her before we lost her.
Thank you for that, because I do mean it. Every time I watch this movie, I'm like, damn it, we just met her and she's so charming instantly. You know, she's carrying some decorations up into the Union Hall and the kids decide to scare her. And one of them has red paint all over his face and he jumps out and frightens her and she drops her precious little decorations and they get dirty in the mud and everyone feels really bad about it. And now she's going to have to rewash them before the dance. And Armando, as you said before, that she has that great exchange with Howard that you expound upon in the book. So we essentially just get the vibe that everyone's buzzing and excited that for the first time in 20 years, which maybe some of these kids weren't born yet. I mean, they're all probably early 20s, I would say, right?
Right. Some of them were just being conceived when the original tragedy happened.
They certainly don't understand the weight of this. And so the idea of celebrating Valentine's Day for the first time in a city called, or a town called Valentine's Bluffs, is super appealing to them. Also, they're young and horny. So definitely want to get in on that action.
Absolutely.
We learn a couple more things. We learn that TJ is the son of Mayor Haniger. Now, Haniger owns Haniger Mines. TJ is the son of the owner of the mines, and he is really trying to distance himself from his dad. Essentially why he left town on a whim, just to be his own man, and he couldn't do that under the thumb of his father. His dad is, it seems like in the movie, with TJ, he's rough. With everyone else, he's maybe not as rough. That's what I get, at least. Like, his relationship with Chief Newby is a little more amiable, certainly, than it is with his son.
Yeah, he puts a lot of, gives TJ a lot of grief. And
Yeah. Now, we also have Chief Newby, who is the local police officer, who is a good guy, right? He's nice. He cares. He's hard on the kids when he needs to be.
He does his best. He may be a little overconfident, but he feels he's doing the right thing.
Yeah, he also makes some bad decisions in this movie, though, in my opinion.
Yeah, don't close the beaches.
Exactly, yeah.
Makes the fatal mistake.
Very much a Jaws situation of, we're keeping the beaches open. So we're going to go ahead and talk about the kids at the cage. Newbie gets the heart-shaped box before they go to the cage, correct?
Yes, the first one comes that afternoon.
No, and that's the heart of the opening kill woman, right? With the heart on her chest.
Right.
You know, and so you realize, oh, that's the victim. So you make that sort of callback. If you're paying attention, you're like, oh, it must be her. Unless I'm wrong, unless that's somebody else's heart, but it's always been her heart, right? It's like, that's her heart.
That's who I placed it with, yeah.
Right, and so now you realize what the miner is doing. You're like, oh, he's tracking down these beautiful women. So if you've seen that, watching the movie for the first time, you're going like, his MO so far is he's bringing women down into the mine and killing them and delivering hearts. Why? Who knows? It's just creating that intrigue of like, well, what's going on, you know?
Yeah, Chief Newby does consider, you know, whether these are crimes of passion, you know, that will target until, you know, the male victims turn up. It does appear at first that, you know, he's just killing women, but that ends up not being the case at all.
Right.
Not even a little bit.
Well, it's like, have you ever seen how, like, if you're watching, I mean, this is a quick sidebar. I know we're pressed for time, but like, if you watch Halloween, what does Michael do? The first thing he does is he comes out and he's killing dogs. like he kills Lester, mm-hmm. right? He kills this other dog that eats in the miner's house. And if you're watching Halloween for the first time, you're like, oh, he escaped to come back home and he's like killing people's pets. You know, like you're like, what's going on?
Like, oh no, I never thought of this.
That's what I mean. Like, oh my God, he's an animal killer. But I think like in My Bloody Valentine, you're like, oh, he's just killing women and just, you know, putting their hearts in boxes. And you're not realizing really what's going on. And if you think about if you were Mayor Haniger, if you were Chief Newby, you'd be like, you'd have to figure out what's going on. You wouldn't jump to the conclusion that, oh, it's Harry Warden is punishing everyone for having a dance. You know what I mean? Like, it's the first sign that something's really wrong here. And even they question, is this Harry Warden? He couldn't possibly be back. And so what do? They call the sanitarium and they try to track him down and see what happened to him. You know, it really does lull you into the story. What is the Valentine poem that is on that first card. Do you remember it, Armando?
From the heart comes a warning of bloody good cheer. Remember what happened as the 14th draws near.
Right. Like, what does that mean? What does that mean? You know, you think he would have just said, just don't hold the Valentine's Day dance and you'll all freaking live. You know what I mean? Like, but no, he's got to be cryptic about it. And you know, and it's like, he's got a sense of humor. You know, the thing about, like, one of the things you had mentioned, Ricky, was like how great the Miner costume was and how that was really compelling and provocative on a movie screen. Same thing like with Michael. Michael Myers is, you know, there's a playfulness to Michael's character. I mean, he's dropping flower pots, you know, he's carrying gravestones around, you know, he's putting the ghost sheet on. There's a sense of enjoyment to his taunting of you, you know. And so along with this human heart, he delivers this card that, you know, that he thought about how to write it and craft the poem. It's just one of those things. It's very unnerving when you have somebody that's a maniac, a complete maniac, who's running around with no rhyme or reason and slicing people up. That's pretty scary. But you know what's more scary? A maniac that has reason and sort of twists the knife a little more, like makes it more insidious. That's so. I think the Miner right away is showing them, this is the first step to the terror I will bring to your town. And so that's why I think he's a great cinematic villain.
He's passionate about it.
I think that's a great point. There's a plan and a passion behind it. Exactly.
Yeah. Even Han writes his notes, you know, and as Mabel says, a Valentine is more meaningful when it comes from the hand of the person who's sending it. That's what he's doing. He's crafting, he's underlining his letters. He's making everything so nice. It's
decent penmanship, important. I gotta say.
Sure.
For a Miner.
For a Miner. All right, so the sheriff, as we mentioned, is gonna call the insane asylum and be like, has Harry Warden escaped? What is he alive? What is going on? And he has some trouble getting through. That night, the kids go to the cage, the local dive bar, and drink Moosehead beer all night. Of course, TJ and Sarah have a dialogue where Sarah says, you know, where the hell have you been? You didn't tell me you left. Why didn't you write me or anything? And I really like the acting in this movie. We keep talking about how great these characters are. I think sometimes slasher characters are so bad you find yourself rooting for the killer.
And oh my God, that is like, okay, can we talk about the acting? A lot of horror movies nowadays, you don't like anybody. Everybody's got a snarky, sarcastic response. Here, it's like, you know, today, Laurie Hollier's character would have been like, screw you, you don't deserve me. You know, I don't care that you're back. But, you know, it would have, she was hurt. She's like, why didn't you write to me? She calls him Jesse. And you're like, oh, he's, you know, she has like her name, you know, that she calls him. And you really feel for her. And you really get the sense that he's like, I was wrong. I don't know. I had a problem. Like, you really get a sense that these are real people as opposed to, you know, like Marcia Brady, like flipping her hair back and being like, well, I don't have to deal with you anymore. You know, I don't know. It's like, I love the way that these characters were written and how they were portrayed. You really, they don't give you a lot of reasons to not like them. They give you all the reasons to like them. And I think that's like in that scene, I love that scene. They're on the bluffs. You know, you just fall in love with these characters and I really got the sense that TJ was like, I'm so sorry and I'm back and I want this to work. You know, I never really liked Axel. You know what I mean? He's hard to like in this movie because he just seems like this dick, you know? But not TJ. I was rooting for him.
The likability of these characters makes it all the more devastating when we lose them, right? Because you don't want to see it happen. And Axel is a dick. I gotta say, it's a really sexy cast too, though. There are some very good looking men and women in this movie.
Oh yeah.
Sure. So they kind of get into a tiff with Happy, the owner and bartender of the cage, who goes on a rant. He's a mean, miserable old man, and he recalls the story of what happened in the mine. Armando, do you want to tell us what Happy says?
Oh, he has his own rhymes too. Like he's playing it up. He just loves to scare young people and make everybody as miserable as him. But you know, Harry Warden made his, you know, gave him a life of misery, and he's just, you know, paying it back to everybody else. Like, oh, you think you can be happy? Well, let me tell you what happens, you know. But Happy's great. I thrilled to get to work with that character. And I'll say I loved every character in this book. They're all fun to write. But the actors brought so much to those performances and really made us believe and fall in love with them. And what I have discovered is the cast and crew have great love for each other. And it seems like a lot of people brought their own personalities.
Yeah.
And were given free rein to create these characters on screen. And so there's a lot of reverence for not just the characters, but for the actors who portrayed them. And I was aware of that when writing this book, to even honor the performers who brought these characters to life.
And that must have been hard to do. I mean, there's a Harriet, a Happy, a Howard,
so many,
and a Harry. Like, this, you know, like, it's like, how do you keep track of all the, like, why weren't they named, you know, John, Ben, you know, like, I mean, like, easierly, you know,
and there's a Harvey.
So on top of there being so many cast, you have to, like, wait, who's Harriet? It took me like three viewings to go, oh, Harriet is Mike's girlfriend. Like, I thought she was just the waitress at the bar. Like, you're like, oh, like, the cast is, you know, huge.
Even yesterday.
Yeah, but, you know, Happy is like Happy is like the crazy Ralph of My Bloody Valentine, you know? And those characters, they serve a purpose, you know? They're the ones that are like, they're telling you, the audience at home, something bad is coming, but they're also telling the people in the movie something bad is coming. Like, they serve a very specific purpose. And Happy is another one of those characters. Like, what's this guy's life? Like, why didn't we ever see him? Like, who does he live with? Who's he dating? You know, in the novel, Armando covers all of that. You get to know who Happy is in the novel, for sure. Yeah.
Well, and in the film, Happy takes this time to tell us the story of Harry Warden and how 20 years ago there was an accident in the mine. There was an explosion, a methane gas explosion. Two of the supervisors had left early to go to a Valentine's Day dance, and they left their miners behind. And so no one was monitoring the methane gas levels. There's an explosion, and five miners get trapped down under the mine. And it takes weeks and weeks of excavation to save these people. And when they remove a rock and they finally get through to where these miners are, there's only one of them left, and it's Harry Warden. And he has this crazed look in his eyes, and he lets out this bizarre animalistic scream, and he's eating somebody's arm, and he has resorted to cannibalism to survive. And the of course, your book goes into great detail about this. I fucking love it. But in the movie, we learn that he is sent to an insane asylum because he's not normal. How could you be normal after all of this? I just love that you describe, you know, that his eyes are super dilated because he's been in the dark all this time. And it's just, you know, very thoughtful things. The movie, the sequence happens so quickly in the film,
right,
that it's really great to get the time to really sink into really how isolating and terrifying. I mean, you can't fucking see anything, you know, and people killing each other.
Yeah, we get to wallow in his misery for a while. It makes us understand, though, why he snapped, you know, to
he's
a degree.
He absolutely snaps. And a year after he's been institutionalized, he returns to Valentine Bluffs and gets his revenge on the two supervisors who left them stranded down there. Kills one of them as he's getting dressed, and then gets... The film only shows one of them get killed. Is that wrong?
No, that's correct. Film only, you know, they described the two murders, but the film only showed us one.
Happy finishes his little speech by saying Harry Warden returns every Valentine's Day to stalk the streets and ensure that nobody's celebrating. And of course, the kids say, piss on Harry Warden. We don't believe any of this. And Happy gets real upset about that. He's, you know, he's not happy with...
It's easy to dismiss his story because, quite frankly, you know, a bunch of dead teenagers aren't popping up every year. So right. He must be, you know, fooling them. But, you know, the story kind of lingers, you know, back there, and it kind of has a habit of returning when you're walking alone through the town in the middle of the night. And absolutely, the dogs are howling, and then suddenly you can remember that story, and it's no longer so fanciful.
Do you guys think that, I have a question for you guys. Do you think that, I mean, very clearly they're painting the picture that it is Harry Warden. Do you think that, because I've never really figured out if it was intentional to create this as a whodunit because of, you know, the twist later on. You know, Happy could easily be, you could easily point to him and be like, well, he's doing it, you know, but it seems like it's written as not a whodunit. If you watch a movie like Scream, it's clearly someone's under the mask and no one knows who's doing it. And we will find out. But here, it very quickly, it's set up that it is Harry Warden. You know, it's Harry's back. So do you think they were trying, to create this as a whodunit as, well, it may not be Harry Warden, because I don't think it's very clear in the film.
I think George was had his eye on the whodunit aspect. Things like the way when we first go to the Union Hall and Sylvia and John unite there and he picks her up off the ground and does the kiss. And then when the miners killing her in the showers later, he picks her up in the same
way. That's a really good point. You know, I never thought of that. That is a really good point.
Yeah, it kind of makes us think for a moment, is that John? Or it could be John? You know, things like that, or just the boots matching of, which is another thing that they brought back in Scream. But I felt like Chief Newby's boots and the miner's boots at times were framed to make you uncertain.
Yeah, and yeah. Okay.
Wondering if he could be in the suit or...
Does it take away from the twist? Like, if you're tipping your hand to like, oh, it could be any one of these people, that's my question. You know, it didn't for me. And when I first saw it, I was like, oh my god, it's, you know,
even
I don't know if they're revealing things, but
Haniger and Newby were kind of arguing, you know, with each other, you know, but couldn't this really be Harry? But they leave the possibility open that this could not. Also not be him.
Right.
And so I always felt a strong whodunit and ambiguity to who might the killer be.
Yeah.
There's even a fake out later on in the film when we see the pickaxe dragging on the ground and then it pans up and it's Happy with a pickaxe in his hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a brief moment of, oh shit, is it Happy?
Yeah. And I love that scene, by the way. I love this crazy old man out and like, you know, like he's just out late at night and he's laughing and, you know, he's been drinking. I love that scene. I love it. I can watch it over and over. He's just so fun to watch.
I oftentimes do rewind it when he laughs again and again and again. But so after this whole sequence with Happy, we do cut to the saddest part of the movie, which is Mabel at her laundrette. And she's washing those hearts that got dirtied before. And unfortunately, this is her demise. She notices there's a little box of chocolates on her like washing counter or whatever. The lights go out, and suddenly behind her, the miner appears, and she is pursued. She's backing up, and she's opening dryer after dryer after dryer to try to, I don't know, stop him. It doesn't seem like it would do much good, but it looks good on camera, right? And her performance in this is really,
it's fantastic, really
solid. I mean, she's scared, and she falls down. The miner gets her. It's real upsetting.
She thinks she's going to turn around and see Jake. You know, when she says Jake, you know, for, you know, like this is a woman who is filled with love and oh my God, who was it, Jake? And then immediately she's attacked. I mean, her performance is great. I mean, Oscar winning, I don't know, but like really, like you really feel for her. And you so, do. Yeah.
And she, at the last moment, she does feel that it's Harry Warden. She sees where she may have accidentally resurrected him. Just by breaking the legend in a way, she kind of understands, oh shit, I'm responsible.
It's an interesting thing because there are so many people responsible in this, right? I mean, mm-hmm. TJ inviting his friends down to the mine, Mabel starting the party, Officer Newby, Chief Newby, like not reporting it immediately. It really feeds into the town truly is haunted by this experience and every, you know, the blame to be placed all over the place. Just because of the negligence. The next morning, Chief Newby does go to see her and uncovers her corpse in a dryer, and it's real nasty. Now, this, am I mistaken in thinking that there is more lost footage of her reveal?
Oh, there is. They spent the, Yes, there is. There's cut footage of Newbie looking down at her body swirling as the door is opened. She comes tumbling out and she's turning. And you see this corpse just turning and turning. It's really hard to watch. Really, I mean, I've seen it. We've all seen everything as horror movies, but it's what's happened to her that's so gruesome that it's hard to watch, to be honest with you. I was like, wow, I could see why they cut it. It's just disturbing. Really disturbing. Yeah,
he makes her unrecognizable, which is a really horrible thing.
And he's made a character you love unrecognizable. That's, I think, what's all you're thinking is, oh my God, that's Mabel. You know, like, you're not like, who's that? Yeah. Who died? You know, it's Mabel. Oh, well, you know.
And when the mayor arrives, he mentions how bad the smell is as well. Like, she's cooked in that dryer. You know, it's really upsetting. Yeah. They open the box that was on the counter and there's another heart. And I believe the rhyme is roses are red, violets are blue.
No, this is dead, so are you.
Or wait, is that the, does Mabel
that's
read
what
that?
Mabel reads. Yeah, that's what Mabel reads.
That's what Mabel reads. Okay. Right before she gets it. Chief Newbie says, we're not going to tell people. If that happens, there's going to be police everywhere.
Well, it's like, you know, like they tell everyone she had a heart attack and Happy's like, heart attack my ass. You know, I'm like, I love Happy, you know, but it's like, of course they're going to not alarm the people. They're going to try and contain this and, you know, but they have to cancel the dance, of course, because it's getting worse, you know.
Exactly.
I love Happy.
But they do cancel the dance and they tell the kids it's because Mabel died of a heart attack, and the kids are like, no, she would have wanted us to follow through with it. You don't understand her the way we do, but dance is canceled. Yep. No parties, no nothing. Stay in your homes. So the kids are at the bar and is it Howard that comes up with the idea of throwing a party? And have a Valentine's party.
Actually, I think TJ suggests it, and then Howard kind of appropriates his suggestion.
Great. And then TJ suggests, let's do it in my dad's mine. And Happy overhears all of this and says, you guys don't want to fuck around with Harry Warden. And they don't believe him. And so Happy decides to get his own revenge. And he does this by going to the mine before the kids get there. And he sets up this elaborate, almost like a Home Alone style, like, prank. Where when they open a door in the mine, a dummy of Harry Warden raises an axe above their heads. And so he does this again and again, and he's drunk off his ass and he's laughing every time he opens this door. And so he starts to walk away and then he goes, one more time. And he opens the door and it's actually Harry Warden. And he digs his axe up through his skull, like through where the jawline would be. And it's another kill I wish we got to see more of in the original cut. But alas, 86, poor Happy.
It seems that Happy had courage when he drank. You know, he's telling everyone, like, he's convinced this guy is going to come back and, you know, this guy is going to kill everybody. You know, what's he doing? Why is it for his own safety? What is he doing? What is he doing out there doing this prank when he's completely isolated and he knows Harry's coming back? But I think when he's got courage and he's not thinking straight, it's just fun to watch this, not lunatic. He's not a lunatic, but he's drunk. He's a drunk, careless guy who's just out there setting up this trap. You're like, what are you doing? Like, you're a sitting duck if you're going to do that. Like, I think even he was like, I knew this was going to happen. Like, oh, I hoped this wouldn't, but I knew it would. I mean,
because he's probably the most afraid of Harry and he's the one who's hanging out at the mines.
That's what I'm saying.
I want to touch base. Let's touch base with the TJ Sarah Axel situation, because earlier in the day, TJ abducts her, like, not maliciously, but she gets in the car with him and they go to this really romantic spot on the bluffs, and it's almost like a completely different movie at this point. They have a heart to heart a little bit, and he tries to win her back, and you know, she's just upset. Why didn't you write me? Where the hell have you been? Like, you, I deserve more than this. You just up and left me. And it is a good scene between them. I really think they are a couple of leads that you can really root for.
She has a realistic grievance.
Like,
I really feel bad for her. You know, it's quite a dick move that he pulls on her, and it's tough for him to justify.
Yeah.
And ultimately, like, I can totally understand her hurt toward him, you know, throughout that whole thing. And it doesn't, you know, that it becomes a tender sequence, but then in the book we do see where that it goes in a totally different direction from where the film cut it. The film cuts it only at the halfway point, and
yeah,
we lost a lot, which was in the script.
Really? I wonder
she
that.
She ends up him down, and they have a huge fight on the bluffs, and she walks back to town and detours through the cemetery, and surprise, the miner's there. You know, that was all originally in the script, but didn't make it to the film. So that was a joy to get to explore.
It's so cool being able to have these scenes restored, because as it is a wonderful film and I have seen it countless times, there are moments where I feel like something, like it's apparent something was missing, you know, and it's certainly not the filmmaker's fault. It's the MPAA and cutting for time. And, you know, these things happen, but it's really cool to get to see them restored and kind of left up to the imagination as well. The graveyard scene in the book is cool because I had no reference for it in my mind. It's just not there.
And, you know, that whole sequence was so important because we finally get to understand what TJ did out west. And I think that's always been one of the biggest mysteries of the movie. Everybody's always going, what did TJ do during that missing year? You know, and it makes the town, you know, suspicious of him, that he might be different when he comes back, which kind of puts him in the possible, you know, makes it possible that he's the killer, because we don't know what happened. But
absolutely,
I have to say, George, you know, was vague about what that year was and really allowed me to explore it completely. And I think that's one of the big mysteries everybody's always wondered. Everybody's always asking what happened to TJ for that year. And I love that part of the book, getting to take that journey of the whole year with him and seeing just exactly what he did and how stupid he was and how bad he blows it. And why he goes back to Valentine Bluffs with his tail between his legs, you know.
Absolutely.
And it's no longer, you know, he's forfeited his position in the hierarchy of the town and who he is. And it makes him, you know, unsure of himself. He's kind of lost too. But, you know, I can understand Sarah, you know. Why didn't you take her along? Why didn't you even ask?
Yeah,
you know, her grievances are totally real.
Yeah. Yeah, she's allowed to feel the way that she feels. It's also worth noting that Valentine's Day this year is on Saturday the 14th, which means it's the day after Friday the 13th, which the movie never explicitly says, but it's there, which I think is pretty clever. The kids go to the party at the mine, and they're having a great time until Axel and TJ get into a big old testosterone, hosing the deck down with it, trying to... They fight, basically. TJ gets his ass kicked. Hollis is a big guy, and he stops it. I love the shot where he's holding them both in a different arm, and they can't get out of it.
I love that. I love how he's like, you guys calm down, or whatever. It's just like, that's the guy who would have done it. And like, I love that there's a brawl over a woman. Like, it just loved it. It was just like,
yeah.
And she's just like, I'm sick of both of you. Like, I'm out of here.
They've almost come to blows a couple of times already, because there's the scene in the mine where they start to fight. There's a scene in the junkyard where TJ tries to talk to Axel and it doesn't go well. And so this was a long time coming, and it's a great scene. It's a real great scene.
Yeah.
When TJ says, that's it, and he turns around to try to hit him, it's a little iconic, I think. A lot is happening at once, because Dave, who's been smoking weed, gets the munchies and goes into the kitchen to get a hot dog. And he leans over this boiling hot dog water, and from behind, his face gets shoved down into the pot of boiling water. The way you describe this in the book is fucking disgusting, and I loved it. And he is boiled to death. And that's the end of him. While this is happening, John and Sylvia have entered kind of the dressing area. And so they are making out and making love under where the uniforms hang from the ceiling. And the whole deal is you pull on a cord and this uniform drops down real fast, and you have access to it. So John goes to get a couple of beers, and while he's away, Sylvia is viciously attacked. It's a really scary scene. Uniforms stop dropping one by one everywhere. Every time she takes a step, a uniform stops in front of her. And her acting is incredible. The screams are real. It's shot really well. And she eventually, one of the uniforms turns out to actually be real. And it's the miner. And just like John had picked her up before, the miner picks her up by her head. And she essentially gets impaled onto a shower pipe and becomes a human shower head. It's so
gruesome.
Sad. And it's so sad.
When the miner grabs her face and the light is shining and she's screaming, go watch that scene. That looks real. That looks like Ellen Udi is her name. That looks real and she is terrified. If you are an actor, you're listening to this and you want to know how to act in a horror movie, that scene should be on your list of like, you need to sell what's happening. I mean, the fact is on set, she's completely safe. It's not happening, you know, but she makes it look like it. And, you know, the cut footage, I mean, I was watching it last night. I went out to dinner after our event, Armando, with a friend, and he's like, I haven't seen the uncut footage. Well, I looked it up on YouTube. It is harrowing what happens to her, to see her hanging there with like this pipe coming out of her mouth. You know, it is so gruesome what this man is doing, you know, and he's like functioning normally around people. Like he's fighting with a dude over, you know, a girl, you know, but then also he's like impaling people. It's really, I don't want to say disconcerting. It's just, awful is what it is. This is a real gruesome, sinister horror movie. And people think, oh, My Bloody Valentine is a simple slasher movie. Well, it's really not. It's one of the really, really great ones. And that gets under your skin. It's sinister. And that I talked about that with George when we were designing the game. I was like, listen, I know this is a board game and we're going to have fun with it, but I do recognize that your movie is insidious. It's like a sinister film. And he's like, I'm glad you understand that, Anthony. You know, sick. Yeah. Pretty sick. Yeah.
It's sorry, my cat is climbing my bedroom curtain. What is wrong with you? Put it down.
He wants out.
Yeah.
He's like, I hate horror movies. I can't hear this anymore.
Oh, all right. So a group of the kids decide to go down into the mine and explore. The women have never been down in the mine before. So they take the mine cars. And I gotta say, the filmmaker's access to these mines is very impressive. Even the cinematography on the mine cars, especially when there's the chase on the mine cars a little bit later, is really cool. I read that they couldn't use certain lighting instruments because it was at risk of explosion, which is pretty scary if you ask me.
Yeah.
Kind of simultaneously, Dave's dead body is found in the refrigerator right as John busts into the rec room where the party is, announcing these two people are dead. John is, his performance is real good. I gotta say, he's, you know, in complete shock. And so these partygoers get the hell out of there and they find Chief Newby and say, you know, you got to get to the mines. Harry Warden is there. So Chief Newby goes and he brings the whole town with him. it's a bunch of people with shovels and pickaxes and they're ready to save these kids. But unfortunately, it's too late because they're getting picked off one by one down below. Harriet and Mike give themselves to each other sexually. And unfortunately, they get, as they're making love, they get impaled through from heart to heart with a giant auger drill. And it is a scene that is infamously not replaceable. That footage cannot be found. It's a real bummer. We do see the aftermath briefly, but it, you know, as I mentioned before, a great addition to the novel was having that scene restored. Hollis gets shot in the head with a couple of nails while he's trying to protect the girls. It's the atmospheric setting in the mines is really well done. And I think it was partially because they're real mines, partially great filmmaking. You know, the scene where Harry is pursuing them and he's just busting the lights on the swing on the string with his pickaxe is really fucking scary. And while the kids don't have a sense of where they are in the mine, we as an audience certainly do not. Unfortunately, Patty, who is, in my opinion, a really likable character.
Oh, who doesn't love Patty? Oh my God.
She gets it in the gut. I mean, after Hollis, her boyfriend dies, she loses it, and she.
I love her performance. She's just like freaking out. Wouldn't you? I mean, a lot of these, like in Final Destination, you know, like some. I love Final Destination. I'm not dinging it, but it's like teenagers seem to get over the tragedy pretty quickly. Yeah. You know, even in Scream, it's like somebody was murdered. Tatum was murdered. Well, they're back at school the next day. You know, and like talking about it. Here, she's like, "Oh my god!" And you know, and Sarah's like, we have to go. We need to go. And it's like, it felt real. And that sense of isolation being locked, like horror movies are about isolation. You know, they're in a mine. They can't just like, if they held this Valentine party in someone's living room, in Hollis's living room, you know, they could all run out the door and go home. Here, they're stuck in a mine. And so it creates this little, you know, pressure cooker. So it was a great place to have a showdown for sure.
Now it's really clever breaking up TJ and Axel continuously from the group, right? They go down after to go save these kids once they find out that people are dying. And so, you know, I mean, just back to Patty, the whole scene on the ladder when they're trying to climb the ladder and get out is so good and so intense. It's also, I love in the book that you mention a couple times, should I slap her again? Or has anybody even thought about slapping her? Because as much as I love her performance, you're also a little bit like, shut the fuck up and climb the ladder.
Everybody wanted to slap her.
Yeah. So good. But unfortunately, she meets her end in a really grisly way. And I love what happens in the book. It adds a lot of sadness to it because that is Sarah's best friend.
Yeah, she gets it the worst almost. And so far as the book elaborating on death scenes, Patty was the one that we really go overboard and make you feel bad for, but also feel just it's gruesome, beyond gruesome.
Now, at a point, Axel has fallen into the sump, which is this giant body of water 60 feet deep underground. And they're unable to retrieve him. They see his hard hat sink under the water with bubbles. And so Axel is a goner. We come to a point. Howard also gets it real bad. real bad. I love the description in the book. But at a point, we are left with strictly TJ and Sarah with the miner in pursuit. And they jump on a couple of mine cars. And there's a chase where they're jumping from mine car to mine car. Again, for a film of this budget, really impressive.
Very impressive. Yeah.
Cinematography, just the action is great. They fall off of the mine car. There's a TJ has a shovel. The miner has the pickaxe, and they're battling with it. And Sarah, at a point, you know, she's not like a stand by the sidelines, somebody save me person, right? She throws TJ the shovel, and they carry this battle into an abandoned, forbidden zone of the mine. It's this little room that's clearly about to fall apart. There's a point where she grabs a giant boulder and like hits the miner with it, trying to help TJ as he fights. It's a great scene. It's really intense. The miner's pickaxe keeps running, like hitting these wooden beams, and he pulls it out and then rocks start falling. It's a small, tiny space for them to be fighting like this in. The miner gets TJ on his back. His pick is stuck in the wall. He pulls out his hunting knife and he's about to stab TJ. And right before he does, Sarah pulls his mask off, and it's Axel. He did not die in the sump. And she says, or I think it's TJ says, Axel, why? And we see a flashback. And one of those supervisors 20 years ago who left the miners down there is getting ready to go to, he's just putting on his tie, and he's killed by Harry Warden. And we see a little boy hiding under the bed watching this happen. And it turns out to be Axel as a little kid.
Yeah.
And this is where it's all lied inside of him. The book goes into great detail about his mental decay. This whole sequence is very quick. The last like few minutes of this movie are very fast. Right. So I appreciate the book taking a moment to be able to expound upon it.
Yeah, you got to take a bit and understand why.
Yeah.
You know, how he got here. And it's, it's sad. Ultimately, it's sad. I feel a lot of sympathy for the killer in this one.
Yeah.
Same. Now, TJ uses some great core strength and grabs a boulder from behind his head and sits up and hits Axel with it. And he slams against the wall and a bunch of rocks fall on him. TJ and Sarah run out. They're greeted by the search party and they say, he's in there, and it's not Harry Warden. It's Axel. And Chief Newby says, I know it's not Harry Warden. I found out from the insane asylum. He died 5 years ago. Can't believe it's Axel. Oh my God. What a surprise. They get in there and Axel's hand reaches out and he's still alive. And Sarah runs in. I have to see him. So Sarah and TJ run in and Axel, I wish the movie showed it better, but unfortunately it must've been cut, cuts off his arm at the elbow to escape. And so he, you know, you can see through the rubble that he's backing away and he's lost his fucking mind. And he warns Chief Newby, we'll be back. I think he uses plural, we'll be back, like him and Harry, right?
Yeah.
And he says, Sarah, in his spooky, creepy voice, be my bloody Valentine.
I'll be waiting in hell for you.
Harry, Harry, I'm coming. This whole fucking town is going to die. We're coming back, you bastards. Sarah, be my bloody Valentine. Daddy gone away. Harry Warden made you pay.
Such a chilling exit. Such a chilling ending.
So scary. And yeah. He backs away. We see him kind of fade out into the darkness of the mine. And that's the end of the movie. Credits roll. And we get this really great folk song. The Ballad of Harry Warden.
Once upon a time, on a sad Valentine, in a place known as Hanniger Mine, a legend began. Every woman and man would always remember the time.
Comes out of nowhere. I'm a singer. I'm a musical theater nerd. I'm actually thinking about putting together a cabaret of horror movie theme songs, right? Oh, like Pet Cemetery, cool. And Fright Night and all these movies. My Happy Birthday to Me had one. And anyway, I would obviously include this song in it.
They say on a Valentine's Day is a curse that'll live on, and no one will know as the years come and go. Of the horror from long time ago.
And that's the film. I have a question for you guys. What do you think happened to Axel? Do you think he dies down there in the mine? Do you think he escapes?
Damn, I wish the sequel came out. You know, it's such a sad. It was like one thing if this movie came out in 1989. You could argue, well, that was kind of the end of that era. Like, there was hundreds and hundreds of movies, but this was 1981, and it should have had a 2 and a 3 and a 4.
Yep.
And then they went and remade it in 2009, and that was great. It had great box office, and that still. So you have this like franchise that was created twice, and it never really went anywhere. So
agreed.
I don't know. I would like to think he came back the next year and just hunted everybody down. And you know, that's what I think. I mean, he's clearly insane at this point. I mean, he's gone off the deep end. So
yeah,
that's what I think happened to him.
Yeah, there's no more Axel by that point.
Well, I do know what happened to him. I know what happened to him, but I can't say.
George still wants a sequel, is that correct?
Yes. In fact, before I wrote a word on this book, he fully went through his follow-up.
Wow.
With me. And so I, from the get-go, I knew exactly where the story could potentially go in the future. And it was all worked into this book. So we purposely put threads and clues within the text of this book that we can pick up later when we can revisit and give the story a proper follow-up. So I do know what happened to Axel.
That makes you officially the coolest person I've ever met. So
I hope the interest, you know, that this has enough interest to where we can finally get George's sequel, whether it's in film or book form, who knows. But either way, it would be very enjoyable for us to see where this was supposed to go.
Yeah. Damn. I hope we get both film and book.
Oh, me too. Me too.
Well, listen, guys, on the Rick or Treat Horrorcast, we have a rating system. A movie is either a trick, which means it's pretty good. It's a treat, which means you love it. Or it's a smell my feet, which means it sucked. And I guess I can assume we're all going to say the same thing. I mean, for me, this movie is a treat.
Oh, mm-hmm. Treat for sure. Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
there is a timelessness to it. It mm-hmm. it is effective every time. I do notice something new every time that I watch it. And now having read the book and played the board game, my experience is only amplified. And so I thank you both so much for the creative work that you've put in, because you're doing great things.
You're welcome.
You really are.
I'm talking about the creation of the board game. It was just really fun. I mean, one of the expansion packs has 30 trivia questions in it. And, you know, I was watching the movie and I was looking for things I hadn't seen before. You know, one of the trivia questions is, you know, what is Mike feeding to Harriet in the scene where they decide to hold their party? You know, and it's like, well, I was, you know, there's an answer to that. You know, I was just like a little thing. I was digging for things I hadn't seen before. And so it was fun to immerse myself into one of my favorite horror movies. And I'm still trying to find Moosehead Beer in LA. I can't find it. So like, I'm dying to find Moosehead Beer. Maybe they don't make it anymore. But last night I saw a picture, Armando, of somebody drinking Moosehead Beer. They had bought the game and went home and they had it. I'm like, where did you get this freaking beer? But so I'm so glad that it's part of your My Bloody Valentine experience now, Ricky. So thank you so much.
An annual thing. I'm sure I'll also visit it throughout the year as well. And I can't thank you both enough for taking the time to meet with me and be on the show. It's really been a pleasure. I could talk to you both all day. I've been looking forward to this.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Anytime. You guys are welcome back anytime. I can't wait to get my hands on upcoming games and books. And that's the show that we have for y'all. Oh, real quick. Where can my listeners stalk you?
StopTheKiller.com. Just find me there. If you want to know anything about my productions, just go to MasseyMedia.net. You can learn what I've done for my documentaries.
And I'm just at on Facebook and Twitter, I believe, at Armando Munoz. On Instagram, Pervula1, Pervula being my DJ name.
And you DJ online, like digital dance parties, too.
Yeah, every week with a group called Dance Darklings. Before the pandemic, I was DJing and, you know, clubs throughout LA. But the pandemic put us all, you know, for a while shut down all the clubs, and I picked it up online. And now I actually really enjoy doing it online. And we have a steady weekly club that's two or three nights a week. And I'm sticking with that for now, because I'd prefer to do that than go out and deal with the public at this particular time. But I can also build big horror sets and costumes for all of my shows, and that's what's a big part of the fun.
Excellent. Well, everybody, please check it out, and thank you again, and I'll see y'all later, spookies.
All right, thanks.
See you, spookies.
Thanks for coming Rick or Treating. You can follow the show on Instagram at Rick or Treat Pod. It'd be a real scream if you'd take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review the show on whatever platform you're listening on. The show's spooky intro and outro music is a cover of Camille Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre, with orchestrations composed and performed by Lestat von Monlicht. Links to the artist's music can be found in the episode description. Check him out, he's frighteningly talented. Rick or Treat Horrorcast is independently produced by me, Ricky J. Duarte, of Rick or Treat Productions. If you like what you heard, tell a fiend. I mean, friend. If you didn't, well, they're coming to get you, listener.